Good afternoon and welcome to Weekly Sedition, the show dedicated to dissent and alternative lifestyles. This is Contra, your host, this and every Tuesday at noon, right here on 97.3 WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us. Today I'm going to be bringing you some audio from a prison issues conference and a prisoner artwork display that was held at Wesley United Methodist Church this weekend. I say prison issues conference, but people weren't just conferring with each other. There was also a rally on the steps of the church and a march to the Richmond City Jail. These events and more coming up today on Weekly Sedition. Baby sunshine and baby. I received an alert last month about a prison issues conference that was being held at Wesley United on Mechanicsville Turnpike. It was being sponsored and organized by three groups, RIHD, or Resource Information Help for the Disadvantaged, Prisoners and Families for Equal Rights and Justice, and the People United. You'll remember that I re-aired a show last week that involved some members of the People United crossing the Mexican border illegally. As to why an organization that focuses mainly on immigration would be attending a prison issues conference, we'll get to that later. I arrived early at the predominantly African-American church and was directed into the sanctuary, where I began to read through one of the hymnals, recalling my own days as a Christian. The place was almost completely empty, with most of the crowd who was already present downstairs looking at prisoner artwork or outside talking with each other. As I sat there reading, a man entered and paused beside me as he walked down the aisle. He thanked me for coming, but I didn't get the sense that he was one of the organizers. When I asked him why he was here for the conference, he told me one of his greatest concerns was the need for funding prisoner reentry programs, but that this was not something that was abstract to him. He'd recently been released from prison after 19 and a half years.
A lot of people getting out now. Like myself, I did all that time, 19 and a half years, and I got out. And there's a lot of people out there on the streets I see with them brown uniforms on. They got out. They don't have nowhere to go. But you got a lot of reentry programs like halfway houses and other places that will help people. But you got to get them grants. That's the problem, getting grants to them programs. The reentry programs is what's helped me. Like, I came out, got me a job. I'm in a program now. I'm doing good. And if it weren't for them grants of them program, I might not be out here, I might be a homeless person myself. Because it's hard when you got to pay $500 a month in some of these programs. It really is.
Most ex-felons find it difficult to even obtain work, especially in an economy like the one we currently find ourselves a part of. And when they can find work, it often pays minimum wage, or very close to it. For someone making so little, $500 a month is an enormous sum of money, and often they can't or won't pay that much for the services that reentry programs provide. This is why he says it's important to get funding to the reentry programs, although much of the responsibility also rests on the prisoners themselves.
Now, I started my reentry coming out like 3 years before I come out. I'm writing organizations, writing people, say, will you help me with my rehabilitation? So it's on the individual itself, too. You can't wait till like 2 or 3 weeks before you get out. It like take like 2 or 3 years, because prison ain't no rehabilitation place. It take you to rehabilitate yourself, really. You know, people say prison, it take you, because they give you tools to use to go to.
With a 2 or 3 year preparation time, it's no wonder that most prisoners don't end up properly taking advantage of the resources that are there. Still, felons who've been convicted of violent crimes have it much harder, often finding themselves with no way to survive, but to resume the life of crime that they had left.
It's rough, man. for a felon like that. But you got nonviolent fellas like myself, I went in there for distribution of cocaine.
Now he was speaking to one of my personal concerns. Since the beginning of Weekly Sedition, back when WRIR first went on the air, I've been a strong advocate of ending the failed and misguided war on drugs that's wrecking so many communities, for what is essentially a personal choice and a private matter. Prohibition was ruled unconstitutional long ago, and this ruling should apply equally to the coca plant as it does to alcohol, which, statistically, is far more dangerous. I asked him if he would mind sharing with us how much cocaine got him a sentence of 19 and a half years.
Yeah, I don't have no problem. That's one of the keys of people being locked up. 2.0 grams of coke.
2 grams, 19 and a half years.
That's right. That's why people locked up. They taking advantage of people. Something you would blow off the table.
You sneeze 2 grams
yeah,
away on accident.
Gone off the table.
19 years.
That's the key. You see what I'm saying? That's a lot of people like myself locked up right now.
All right.
At Red Onion State Prison. 2.0 grams of coke.
For every person who's locked up like this, a mother loses a child, a community loses a working member, children lose fathers and mothers, all for what is essentially a problem that requires treatment. The war on drugs is a serious problem, but for those of you who appreciate lighthearted takes on serious topics, Bill Hicks is going to help us out for a moment.
Try not to do drugs. I got nothing against drugs. I got nothing against drugs. I think it's a personal choice. Just like alcohol, just like cigarettes. As long as that personal choice does not infringe upon the freedoms of another person's personal choice. Really, that's the end of the story. That's called logic. It'll help you. George Bush says we are losing the war on drugs. Well, you know what that implies? There's a war going on, and people on drugs are winning it. Ah! Well, what does that tell you about drugs? Some smart, creative motherfuckers on that side. They're winning a war and they're fucked up. A lot of y'all don't even know you're fighting, do you? You're sitting there going, I'm watching Saturday Night Live. Are we winning? Look, I feel like my flank is covered. Honey, bring me a beer. Got a war to win. What war is that? You know, the war on drugs is hypocrisy, man. That's why it's not going to work. It's fucking a lie. Alcohol and cigarettes kills more people than crack, coke, and heroin combined. So the war on drugs is really sort of a... getting at it. You alcoholics are going, yeah, we're next. If they're fighting drugs, we can be taken. Drug guys are creative motherfuckers. We're just obnoxious, man. We're fucking out there.
Before long, someone else enters the sanctuary. It's a woman wearing a t-shirt that says Free Latron, with the image of a young man on the front. She sees me conducting the first interview and immediately says that she wants to tell her story too.
My name is Tamara Fuqua, and I'm here representing my husband, who is Latron Anthony Huggins, who is currently incarcerated in Green Rock Correctional Center on a 64-year sentence. He only has to serve 32, according to the Department of Corrections. His offense is first-degree murder, possession of a firearm, and possession of a controlled substance.
Tamara says that Latron was a cocaine dealer at the time he was arrested, just barely.
On the night of the offense, he only had 1 ounce to get rid of. He had found out his one girlfriend was pregnant with their daughter, so he decided to get out the game, exit the game, quit the game, what they call it on the street.
On that night, he approached the passenger side of a car to sell some coke to the woman in the passenger seat and her boyfriend, who was driving. During the deal, the woman grabbed hold of the package from Latron and yelled for her boyfriend to pull away. Latron didn't let go, and, so the story goes, ended up getting caught in the woman's seatbelt.
He was being dragged by the car, and he felt like it was either his life or, you know, something had to happen because his life was in danger. He discharged the firearm that he had, but accidentally hit, bounced off the side of the door frame inside the car and shot the young lady in the chest. And she died later on in the hospital.
This reminded me of a similar story that happened a couple years ago in the area, where a police officer shot an unarmed man during a traffic stop because he wouldn't let go while being dragged by the car. I tried to search for the specific story online to mention it here, but my Google search came up with so many stories of police shooting people after claiming to be dragged by a car that I couldn't find the right one. But this isn't the end of Latron's story.
While he was incarcerated, he saved the life of a correctional officer at her request. And she wrote a letter. She listed the incident report. And I have documents and stuff. I can read it to you. Hold on.
She steps across the church aisle to retrieve a notebook. She opens it to the first page, and I can see that there's a table of contents. I realize that everything about Latron's case is cataloged here. She flips to a page of a photocopied letter and begins to read.
I write this on the behalf of inmate Latron Huggins in the hopes that it will provide the members of the board a view of the changes this inmate has made since his incarceration and why I feel this inmate is ready to be paroled. On 11/01/04, at approximately 14:35 hours, I was chased by an inmate wielding a weapon who intended, in my opinion, to do me serious harm, if not kill me. As the situation unfolded, I ran into inmate L. Huggins' cell, and he put himself between me and the other inmate, shooting me from his view, preventing me from being hurt. I cannot imagine what may have happened had Mr. Huggins not done what he did. I am very thankful for Mr. Huggins' actions that day because he prevented me from being seriously harmed. In my opinion, I believe that Mr. Huggins is ready to return to society as a perfect example of humanity, reformed and rehabilitated. I do believe he will make an excellent candidate for parole. I thank the board for their time in considering this letter and hope that this letter will assist in the board making the decision to grant Mr. Huggins parole.
Tamara argues that if there was ever an instance of a prisoner showing that he had been reformed, showing that he was willing to compensate for his crimes against people, this is it.
I feel like that he took a life, but he also saved one. I'm here today because I want to shed light on his situation and other inmates who are in similar situations who have done 17, 20, 36 years and haven't gotten any relief or any hopes of being released, who have great records, who have no charges. The parole board and the system and the DOC only look at the crime, which will never change. And the only thing that could change is the person, but that's not taken into consideration. When they think about parole or make the decision, all they look at is the crime itself.
Tamara says that a huge part of the reason why so few prisoners who have tried to earn parole are actually granted it is the way in which parole hearings are held. When I think of a parole board, I remember the classic scenes from Shawshank, with Morgan Freeman sitting in front of a table of people who ask him whether he feels he has been rehabilitated yet. Apparently, this is not quite how it works anymore.
There's no person that interviews them. They do it by TV. They go into a room. The inmates go into a room. They look in front of a monitor. It's very, very impersonal. And I think that's because they don't want to get to know the inmate. The colder it is, the more they are able to say no without having any remorse or care because they don't know the person. They're just saying no to a number or a sheet of paper. And not even a face.
So the parole board isn't even actually getting to look at the person while they're judging?
Nope, they don't look at the person at all. All they do is go by fact sheets, the teleprompter monitor, and that's it. And then they rubber stamp. They deny based on the circumstance. So in actuality, they don't even really look at the case at all. He's written to councilmen, congressmen, Ms. Kennedy, different other organizations, to the governor over the years. And we're just trying to make parole. He's been eligible since 1999, but they keep denying him based on the fact of the seriousness of the crime, circumstances of the offense. And that's what they really deny him on ever since.
Call finesse. Where are you? Yo, shit is crazy, boo. Yo, I miss you. Yo, keep put some money in my commissary.
Lil' Kenny been smoking Lucy since he was 12. Now he 25, locked up with an L. They call him Triple K, cause he killed three. Another ghetto child got turned into a killer. His pops was a Vietnam veteran on heroin, used like a pawn by these white North Americans. Mama couldn't handle the stress and went crazy. Grandmama had to raise the baby, just a young boy, born to a life of poverty. Hustling, robbery, whatever brung the paper home. Carried the chrome like a blind man, hold a cane. Tattoos all over his chest so you could know his name. But y'all know how the game go. D's kicked in the front door, and guess who they came for? A young nigga headed for the pen, coulda been, shoulda been, never see the hood again.
Behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man. Locked up behind enemy lines, my niggas are cellmates. Most of the youth never escape the jail fate. Super maximum camps will advance their game plan to keep us in the hands of the man. Locked up.
Cuando yo llamo es como tú no me quieres escuchar. No he visto mis hijos, mi mujer, no me mandan retratos, no tengo dinero. Estoy aquí jodido en la cárcel, metido.
You ain't got to be locked up to be in prison. Look how we living, 30,000 a day, up in the bin. Standing routine, they put us in a box, just like our life on the block.
Behind enemy
you ain't got to be locked up to be in prison. Look how we living, 30,000 a day, up in the bin. Standing routine, they put us in a box, just like our life on the block.
Behind enemy lines.
I mentioned earlier that at the Prison Issues Conference, I also saw members of the People United, the Virginia Immigrant Rights Group, who staged the illegal border crossing action that I aired on the show last week. I caught up with Jeff Winder after the march to the Richmond City Jail and asked what connection there was between immigration and prison issues.
We do a lot with immigration, but really we're trying to do just this, to bring people together who might have something common in their vision but don't ordinarily work together. And we think prison issues are huge in both, you know, our inner city communities of citizens as well as among immigrants. There's a private corporation that wants to open a 1,000-bed immigrant detention facility in Farmville, Virginia right now. And that's being put out to the white citizen community as an economic boost to their community, something that's going to kind of jumpstart their local economy, while immigrants are living in fear every day that they're going to be arrested because they're driving without a license or had a turn signal not on, and incarcerated for months on end. Also, the privatization of prisons is strongly affecting issues that this conference is dealing with here today, as more and more offenses are criminalized, sentences are made harsher, corporate lobbyists are looking for more places to turn a profit. Both the immigrant community, the inner city African American community, the rural white citizen community, we're all affected by this and we're all hurt. And if we really want to have power to collectively make change, then we need to stop letting them divide us and get along in dialogue with each other and start working together for our common interests.
Another immigrant member of the People United shared with me her perspective through a translator.
Well, it's really important because right now people, the largest number of people being put into prisons are immigrants, and we're being put into jail and abandoned there without even having been charged for anything except for not carrying the proper paperwork. Just working, and they'll come to pick you up at work, and then you're arrested at your job. That's the situation that's happening now. We can't even go to work. If we do go to work, we'll be searched for at our jobs. I don't think that that's just. I want to support everyone who's been incarcerated. They're talking about building a new jail now in Farmville. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's talk of building a new jail detention center in Farmville right now. And that's why I'm here to support the work that's going on.
I want to share with you now a short documentary titled One Nation Under Guard, covering prison issues, that was produced here in Richmond by an acquaintance of mine, Lucas Crost. It won an online competition and jump-started Lucas's career in filmmaking. He and I have had some personal disagreements in the past, but I think this film ended up being excellent, and I'd like to share it with you because it deserves to be shared.
My dad, he likes to take me places and see my little sister. And
when's the last time you spent time with your dad?
As Americans, the need to defend the human rights of those in need is a massive part of who we are. We become very quick to judge those worldwide for their shortcomings. We need to hold up that deep, dark, truthful mirror and take a good look at ourselves, look at our own injustices. The U.S. has the largest prison population on the planet. And sadly, it's targeting a very specific segment of our society.
What we find in this community is most of the families have just mom in the home. Dad is either not in the children's lives because of being in jail or death. And so a lot of these moms are raising the kids themselves. They see their dad in jail. And I've heard it said by some of our kids, you know, I want to be like my dad.
Well, overwhelmingly, the statistics show that the minority population is overrepresented in the prison system. Black males, I guess, are the number one segment of the population. If you are a black male, you have a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison by the time you're 30. That's huge.
I think what this means is that for many young black men, increasingly young women growing up, there's almost an expectation that prison will be a part of your life cycle. Just as is true for many middle class people, white people growing up, that college was the expectation. So now it is in some neighborhoods that prison is the expectation.
I've actually heard some of these kids say, you know, I did this in school today, I got detention, I'm going to go to jail. I mean, they kind of expect that's their course in life, and so it's undoing that and telling them, no, you did something wrong, you're sorry, that's not going to lead you to jail. You know, we're not going to believe that for you. We're going to believe better for you.
You know, you grow up in upstate Virginia, and the fathers of these kids are in our penitentiaries. The fathers, the men who fathered these kids who run these streets today, are locked up in jails in upstate Virginia. And the police today are back here to get the kids to take them to their daddies. Because these same young men will be, some of them will only have family reunions behind bars. It's not strange for father and son and even granddad to all be in the same prison.
Whether or not people are concerned about conditions in prisons or the prisoners themselves, I think all Americans are very concerned about crime. And our approach to dealing with crime for the last 30 years has primarily involved incarceration as our first policy of choice. And I think this has been a very ineffective way to use resources.
I don't believe that there's an us and them. I think that we are them and they are us. It's a myth to think that there is this wall. There are 650,000 people coming out of our system every year. Wherever they've gone and whatever's happened to them and whatever they've been exposed to, whether it be disease or abuse, is what they're bringing back with them.
We have over 2 million people locked up in our jails and prisons in this country. Largest percentage of any country that I know of on the planet. We have filled up our jails and prisons and built them as fast as we could based on economics, because it became one of the largest businesses, the most profitable businesses in this country.
Obviously they employ quite a large number of people. In fact, there are places you can go to in America where prisons are the number one source of employment. There's one county in Colorado where there are 13 prisons, 9 state and 4 federal prisons.
Morgan County has a very good relationship and a very good history as far as corrections are concerned. We're very anxious for it to be located here, but it's not yet a done deal. In theory, you could zero out your unemployment nearly with that many jobs.
Rural communities often competing against each other to have new prisons built in their communities, and prisons become viewed as a source of economic opportunity for certain people. If we are going to build prisons, it seems like we should have a discussion about whether it's necessary for crime control. We shouldn't be doing that just to generate jobs for communities that are hard hit by low levels of employment.
For the purposes of the census, prisoners are counted as being residents in the place where they're incarcerated, and they're added on to the voting power of the districts where they are in prison, even though they can't vote. So what you get is white rural areas with prisons in them doubling their population because they have a prison full of black men, and that voting power is taken from the neighborhoods where they came from, the black neighborhoods, and given to the neighborhoods where they go to, the white neighborhoods. The census is used for allocating all kinds of federal grants. So the more people in a district, the more money they get.
This reallocation of population and power
is further disenfranchising a people who already have no resources and whose population has become a commodity. Even more disturbing is that prisons have become a $40 billion industry, with the private sector running correctional corporations.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, anytime a public use or a public facility ends up going into a private lease or contract, then the purposes for which the institution was established changes automatically. It shifts. Because no longer are we concerned about maintaining people in facilities for their safety, security, their reformation, rehabilitation, wherever it is, on behalf of the public. But now we have a situation where these people are maintained in a privately run institution for profit.
The prison industry is very, very efficient in the fact that it does recycle two-thirds of the raw material. And what I mean by that is what I just said, that two out of every three of the people in the prison system, after they're released, within 3 years, they're back again.
I wish every person in this country could go inside and see who's really there. And what they would say is, you know what? There are a couple of these folks who probably need to be here. The rest of them need to get some help, get some education, get some treatment, find out how to live a more productive life. But for goodness sakes, stop putting them on my back as a taxpayer. Stop making them worse so they'll commit more crimes. And let's have them out here as productive citizens. Matter of fact, everybody who comes in, when they sit down and talk with these folks, they go, I had no idea these were the folks who are here.
We need to do substance abuse programs, we need to do vocational training, and then we need to have kind of re-entry programs for them to get them into jobs so that if they show that they can do the jobs, they can then start progressing and building their lives.
We know that the stigma of a felony conviction pretty much is with you from now until forever. You know, employers have a right to look at your criminal record. Sometimes other people have a right to look at that as well. And even though you've done your time, you may have rehabilitated yourself in every way possible, there will always be some employers, some other people in society who sort of label you as an ex-felon.
If you wander loose and you don't have a very good job or don't have a job at all, what are you going to do? You go back to selling drugs to make some money, and very shortly after that you're busted by your parole officer and you're back in prison.
Again, that's a short documentary entitled One Nation Under Guard. You can Google that online to see the accompanying video and to find out more about the filmmaker Lucas Crost. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening to Weekly Sedition, and thanks for listening to WRIR. It's Richmond Independent Radio, radio for the rest of us.